You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jamie and Jason. This is episode 98, and today Jamie and I are talking about the resurrection. We're going to look at, obviously, the hope of the resurrection. We are coming up on Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, and so we wanted to talk about this. And we wanted to look at the evidence for the resurrection. Is this something that's truly rooted in history, or is it just kind of a lovely idea that we Christians have latched onto? The other question we want to tackle is, if the evidence for the resurrection is so good, as Jamie and I will tell you, we definitely believe it is very good, then why is it that there are so many people who just don't believe in the resurrection, who deny that it did happen and say things like it's impossible and it's too far-fetched? Kind of kick off what we're going to look at, I wanted to read from 1 Corinthians 15 to understand the resurrection and the central place that it has for Christians. It's good to get a grasp of what the Apostle Paul, who's known as foremost missionary in the early years of the church, what he had to say about it. And he said this in 1 Corinthians 15, beginning in verse 3. He said, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me, for I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God." And he goes on later in that same chapter. In verse 14, he says, "And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith is in vain." And in verse 17, "And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins." Jamie, let's open up this topic a little bit. Why is the resurrection so central to Christianity?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's definitely one we have answered on this podcast before, so we would encourage you to go back if you want to and listen to episode 54, where we dealt with this topic before. Yet, it's so central to the Christian doctrine that it's worth repeating, you know, multiple times. You'll see that with some topics here on this podcast, we'll cover them multiple times because they matter a lot. And so they're well worth, you know, discussing multiple times. The main reason, Jason, to answer the question, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then literally the entirety of the Christian faith falls apart. In fact, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, the entire gospel falls apart. In fact, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, the entire Bible falls apart. I mean, that's not to oversell it, right? It's that important to Christian doctrine. And that's why Paul says, if that's the case, then we're to be massively pitied because literally we invested our lives for nothing. And in fact, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, there is no salvation. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, he wasn't really God. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, he is not the one who has the power over life and death itself. You know, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then we are still very much in our sin. We're still very much separated from God. And now it's hopeless. So there's a lot of reasons that this question really matters. But of course, Paul is also making an argument here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. He's not just presenting you information. He's also making a really good, profound argument as well for the resurrection of Jesus. You know, he specifically points out Peter, James, himself, Paul, and then he talks about the 12 and 500, which includes, as we know from Acts 1, it includes Jesus' brothers as well. So he's making an argument that includes actually Jude as well. And the reason we would include these guys, or the reason Paul focuses on these guys, at least himself, Jude, James, and Peter, is that they all come from various positions of disbelief, right? Peter, of course, believed Jesus until Jesus dies. And then Peter finds himself not sure. What does he do? He goes back to fishing, right? That's what he knew before. That's what he did before. And so he had really given up, in a sense, on what Jesus had said until he encounters, of course, resurrected Jesus. And as a result, then goes on to die for that truth, die holding on to the testimony of the resurrection of Jesus. And as a result, the gospel and the salvation that associates. Now, James and Jude, they're the brothers or half brothers of Jesus. And of course, they didn't believe in Jesus. In fact, they believed Jesus to be crazy. Not only crazy, but he needed them. At one point in the book of Mark, we're told that they came to get Jesus because he was crazy. They wanted to protect other people from Jesus. And then, of course, another time they're mocking Jesus because they're saying, if you are who you say you are, then go to Jerusalem and show yourself, right? Like, why waste it? And of course, Jesus tells them, hey, it's not my time yet. And the Bible author lets us know that the reason they did this was because they did not believe what Jesus was saying. They did not believe. These are his own brothers, did not believe. And yet both James and Jude go to their death proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus, proclaiming Jesus is God, very God, that he was raised from the dead and that the gospel is true. James, of course, we know how he died. He was thrown off the temple. But Jude, we don't know how he died. We do know, and it's recorded in church history, and he's considered a martyr. We understand he did, in fact, die for the testimony of faith. And then, of course, Paul. Paul was busy about the business of persecuting the church, and he encounters the risen Jesus. And actually, we have that encounter where Jesus shows up. And he says, hey, why are you persecuting me? And Paul's like, who are you? And he said, I'm Jesus whom you're persecuting. As a result, Paul ends up going to his death, proclaiming the truth of Jesus. So it's a crazy text, Jason, because he's not only giving us the absolute fundamental truth that Jesus must be resurrected from the dead for all of this to be true, and if not, the entire Christian doctrine falls apart. But he also gives you what I think is one of the strongest evidential arguments for the resurrection of Jesus in more of a historic context in that sense.
Well, it's just incredible when you think of it. Christianity, looking at Christianity alongside all these other world religions, when you break it down, and this is simplifying things, but when you break it down, all of the other world religions essentially say, this is the right way to live. This is the right way to reach enlightenment. This, in other words, this is what you must do to achieve this amazing future. And for Christianity, it's not about this is what you must do first and foremost. First and foremost, it's this is what God has actually done for you, and he did it in history. There's evidence. There's literal facts, historical evidences that show that this is what God did in history. And so when you look at the other religions, like, you could take away some of the historical aspects and you still have the basic gist of the teachings in place. Even with Islam and Muhammad, you still have the basics in the Quran. But with Christianity, you really don't have Christianity apart from the historical sacrificial death, first and foremost, of Jesus, and then his subsequent resurrection. And yes, it does have to be a bodily resurrection. This is something that sadly, even many so-called Christians, this is mostly going to be mainline Protestants and progressive Christians, are going to deny. But this is something where we have to say bodily, because as historians like N.T. Wright and many others have pointed out, resurrection itself means getting up. It's like standing up. It's getting up out of the tomb. You can't just talk about your spirit going through a resurrection. When you use the word anastasis in the Greek, anastasis doesn't mean your spirit will live on or it's gonna rise in some metaphorical way. It's talking about your body getting up physically, and that's what is described of Jesus's body getting up out of the tomb. And I know that looking at different authors like John Shelby Spong, for example, I believe an Anglican bishop. He has said things even as far as if Christians doggedly hang on to the literal interpretation of the resurrection, then Christianity is doomed. He actually said that. If we are going to be so committed to this bodily interpretation of the resurrection, then it's doomed. We're headed for disaster. Well, Paul says the exact opposite. He says that if you don't have the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus, then you are doomed. You have nothing to live for, essentially. You have no hope. And let's be honest, we live in a time when Christians and non-Christians are desperate for hope. We want to know what solid thing can I hold on to that can give me the strength, the endurance, all that I need to carry on in faithfulness. And if you just have this kind of spiritual awakening of Jesus, and that's all that it is, there's nothing historical about it, then that's not enough. That's not enough hope to keep you going. You need to know that Jesus really did defeat death in its entirety. Kind of a humorous story, but back in 2007, I was reading recently that there was a department store called Summerfield. It's pretty well known in the UK. To boost sales, they put out a statement complaining that over a quarter of people don't know why handing out Easter eggs symbolizes the birth of Jesus. And then some reporters called them on it. So of course they corrected their error and instead said, oh no, the Easter egg actually symbolizes the rebirth of Jesus. And as I looked at that story, it was somewhat humorous, but it gives you a glimpse on how badly our culture misunderstands Easter and what it's all about. And really, this is a time for us as Christians to clarify for the world around us, this is what we're celebrating. It's not just some generic hope of peace, hope, and good vibes that we're putting out. This is something that has happened in history, and there is genuine evidence. And that's what I think we should talk about next is what are some of the most important pieces of evidence when it comes to talking about the historical resurrection of Jesus?
There is a lot, absolutely a lot. So let's start with the reality of the life, work, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Let's put it all into one lump sum. There is in historic documentation over 14,000, no, that wasn't a mistake, 14,000 evidence, or what we call historic proofs of Jesus. Now, let's put that into a little bit of perspective. The perspective is this. There's actually more evidence about the reality of the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus than there is that Julius Caesar ever existed, historically speaking. We absolutely have no concern or issue or wonder whether Julius Caesar actually existed, right? That's a well-documented historic fact. We don't question it. It's a real thing. And the question, Jason, is then, are these historic proofs from only Christian scholars and authors? The answer is actually no. There is a lot of historians, whether it be Jewish but non-Christian or even Roman, that speak to the reality of, yep, Jesus lived. Yep, Jesus died. Yep, Jesus was buried. And even that there are persistent claims that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. We have 14,000 proofs, historic proofs, of the existence of Jesus, his birth, his life, his ministry, his death, his burial, his resurrection. That's more historic evidence than almost any person. I mean, think about that, Jason. I am sure you could not find even 1,000 proofs, historic proofs, that I exist. I'm pretty sure. I don't think there are 1,000 that exist, right? You would find maybe some web pages that mention my name. You'd find some real estate documents that maybe mention my name. You'd find some church documents that maybe mention my name. You'd find some people that have met me, right? There's a few of those out there, maybe. But certainly not 1,000, right? I don't think I've met 1,000 people in my life, or at least maybe I've met them, but they wouldn't remember my name or remember me or be able to identify me even in a court of law, right? And yet we're saying not only is there proof historically that Jesus existed, over 14,000 independent historic proofs, in addition to, like Paul presents to us, right, in 1 Corinthians 15, where he says, hey, there were 500 eyewitnesses, plus 12, plus James and Peter and himself. That's a lot of people.
And to kind of just pinpoint how clear some of these stats, some of these facts are that you've already listed, first of all, Jesus died. Like, that is not questioned by any credible historian whatsoever. This is just like, that's a fact. The Romans crucified Jesus, he died. Even more than that, the vast majority of scholars on this area, and I'm not talking about just Christian scholars, like we're only going to talk about Christian scholars. This is the vast majority of scholars of the first century, Jesus scholars, will tell you that yes, the tomb was empty. The tomb was empty. Interestingly, one Oxford professor, he's actually a Hungarian Jew who survived the Holocaust. His name is Géza Vermes. He went in to investigate the resurrection because he was pretty sure, like, there can't be any evidence supporting Christianity, right? And the first thing he set out to disprove was that the tomb was empty on that first Sunday. And after looking at all the possible explanations, maybe the body was removed in error, or maybe the disciples stole the body, or whatever, none of those added up. As a historian, he had to look at it from an objective perspective and say, that just does not make sense. Okay, so look at the disciples stealing the body. First of all, they're in a terrible emotional and mental state at this point. Their leader has just died, right? This is the guy they devoted their life to for 3 years. They were totally convinced he was the Messiah. Some of them had even said he was the Son of God. They had no doubt about it, but then he gets crucified. Well, interestingly, we have other examples of messiahs getting, you know, so-called messiahs, people who were touted as messiahs, getting killed by the Roman Empire in the years leading up to Jesus getting crucified. And after these so-called messiahs died, the entire following disbanded. They were like, okay, we were wrong about that guy. He's obviously not him. So the question is, why did the Jesus movement persist? Okay, so did they steal the body? Well, the problem with that is manifold. First of all, Roman guards were guarding this tomb. We have evidence of that from both inside Scripture and outside Scripture, that armed guards were there. Now, the problem with getting past armed guards is that these guys were trained soldiers of the empire. They were not just pushovers. They, in fact, Roman soldiers who let prisoners go free were executed on the spot. So these guys were highly motivated to keep that tomb sealed and guarded. Secondly, you got to ask, what's the motivation? Why do this act of deception? So you're not in a good emotional state. It doesn't even make sense because your leader has just died. You've given up. You're hiding in the upper room. Why do this? Because, number one, you're going to face persecution right away. Like, it makes sense to, like, come up with this this great scheme and this great deception if somehow you benefit, right? Like, that's just how we humans are. We will deceive others and sometimes do terrible things and deceive people totally. The fact that there is uniform agreement among the followers of Jesus that he was, in fact, raised. And just think about this. Not one of them recanted. Not one of those first apostles said, all right, guys, the jig is up. I don't want to go through this persecution and execution thing. I'm just going to go ahead and tell them we made the whole thing up. Nobody does that. None of them did that. And that fact alone speaks volumes. Because people may die for a lie, as historian Michael Lacona has pointed out. People do sometimes die for a lie. But what you don't find in history is people knowingly deceiving others and then dying for that deception that they are the ones who instigate. People don't die knowingly for a lie. It's just, it goes against the will to live. And yet we have uniform historical evidence that these men, Peter, Paul, James, Jude, Matthew, Thomas, all these guys were killed. John is like the one apostle who didn't get martyred, amazingly. But he did get tortured. He did get persecuted. And so you have to look at all this evidence and say, why would these guys be willing to go through all of that? It just doesn't add up that they stole the body or that there was some deception. The armed guards, as I said, they had every motivation to keep the body in there. They're not going to take the body out. And it's not going to be accidentally removed. And just think about this. If say the body was moved last minute, Joseph of Arimathea, the guy who buried Jesus, didn't know about it. The disciples didn't know about it. All of it is just kind of unknown to them. Well, as soon as these guys start proclaiming Jesus is risen, he is the risen Lord of all, if you're the empire, you're going to exhume the body and show once and for all, prove that Jesus really is dead. But we never find that. We never find that in any of the historical records, inside or outside of the Bible, anybody saying, here's the body of Jesus, we found it. That never comes up. And what we do find is the movement not only continues, but it grows exponentially after Jesus' death, which tells us that there's something going on. And that's why people have talked about this massive hole being ripped in history that just doesn't make sense unless you have the resurrection. This massive hole that needs to be filled, and the only thing that can fill it is the resurrection actually happened. But going back real quick to Geza Vermes, so he looks at all these different theories about what could have happened, how did the tomb end up empty, rules out hallucination, that can't be because there's groups that see Jesus risen from the dead, and hallucinations are individual experiences. He rules out all these explanations. And the sad thing is, he comes to the end of it, and he's just grasping at straws, and he says, look, I've looked at all the skeptical theories of what could have happened to Jesus. It can't be any of those, but I know that Jesus didn't rise from the dead because people don't rise from the dead. And so he debunks all the skeptics out there, and yet he still says, I don't have a rational explanation, but there's got to be one out there. And this kind of will lead to what we're going to talk about next in terms of why do people still not believe in the resurrection?
I'll tell you a little story real quick. I was a couple years ago at the Seattle Science Institute with a pastor friend of mine, and we had gone to listen to a guy. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's the author of the book Physics of Christianity, if you're familiar with that book. He was the one that was speaking at this event. Now, this is not a Christian organization, to my knowledge. It may be. I don't think it is, though. And they just present, you know, speakers on science and science information and stuff like that. So this guy was there to present. His argument was for the existence of God using only physics. And so he went on to make this argument. And after he made this argument, he said, now I'm going to prove that this God, a Unitarian God who has eternally existed in three persons using only physics. And he went on to then prove this. And at the end, he said, does anybody have any questions? Well, this woman stands up in the back and she says, Hi, my name is whatever, I can't remember now, but I'm a professor of physics at the University of Washington. And they began what turned into an impromptu debate. And they debated this for, I don't know, it seemed like a really long time. It was probably only like 30 minutes, maybe 20 minutes. But in my mind, you know, they went from his original presentation, I was only skimming maybe 10% in terms of what he was saying, to now they're having this debate, which is way over my head. I'm not understanding anything they're saying. This has gotten, you know, we're talking smart level 7 going on here. And, at the end of it, the woman says, and this is so interesting, she says, well, your physics is right, but I will not believe it, and sat down. And, you know, Jason, she did him probably the greatest favor, right, in a room full of people like me that were not so bright. We don't really know much about physics. I took one class in physics in college, and, I mean, I did okay, but I didn't remember a whole lot or retain a whole lot. And yet now here you have somebody who's clearly not a believer in Jesus Christ, who clearly knows a lot more than me, is saying, well, what you're saying is true. I just will not believe it. And it makes me think of the parable Jesus tells in Luke chapter 16, where he presents for us, you know, this guy, a rich guy who dies, and he ends up going to hell. And in hell, he looks across the chasm and he sees Father Abraham and he says, hey, can you go warn my brothers so that they don't end up in hell? And Abraham responds by saying, they have the prophets and, you know, they have that to listen to. And he says, yeah, but can't you just go and tell them? And the response from Abraham is, even if somebody raised from the dead, if they won't listen to the prophets, if they won't listen to Moses, they won't even listen to a resurrected one. Speaking to this reality, Jason, it's not a problem of evidence. It's a problem of heart.
I'm not going to say there's nobody out there that just doesn't have enough evidence, because the reality is there have been people like, oh, well, there's countless people. Josh Madel, Lee Strobel, Lou Wallace, Frank Morrison. I could go on and on. There are so many people who, once they actually investigated the evidence and actually did the work of looking into this, then their eyes were open. And God opened their eyes to see the truth of the resurrection, and they didn't deny it. So it could be that you're among those who would say, I just haven't seen the evidence for the resurrection. And maybe that's true. Maybe that's what you need, is you need to pick up a copy of More Than a Carpenter by Josh McDowell or The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, something along those lines to get you started on seeing just how much evidence is out there for the resurrection. But to your point, Jamie, in large part, when we have all this evidence presented to us and we look at it and we say, that just can't be. That just can't be. Part of it, I think, is there is an indoctrination that happens, particularly starting at the college level, universities, you know, kids who have been raised going to church and taught these miracles. They go to university, and what are they taught? Their New Testament or their religious studies professor tells them, essentially, these were great stories. They were helpful. They had great moral messages, moral themes to want to strive for. But in the end, we know better now that miracles don't happen. You press them and you say, well, how do you know they didn't happen? Well, miracles don't happen. We have science. We have zero cases where we can confirm a miracle happened. Well, what they're doing is they're saying that simply because they personally have not experienced a miracle, they know that for all the billions and billions of people out there who have claimed to experience some kind of miracle, whether it be a miracle in their heart, as in coming to faith in Christ after running from him, or to actually experiencing a physical miracle, which there are just so many claims out there. Craig Keener wrote a book documenting all these cases of not just historically, but modern day examples of people saying, no, this was a miracle. There's really no other explanation. They're saying that my personal individual experience is the one that trumps all the other experiences out there. So it doesn't matter what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote about them, and Paul. What matters is my experience. And essentially, they take on the David Hume perspective, which says that we have to start with the reality that miracles don't happen because they would violate nature. That was Hume's big argument. He said it would be a violation of the laws of nature. But you have to ask yourself, how do you know it's a violation? How do you know that the laws of nature that we, by the way, they're just a description of what we see normally. How do we know that if there is a God, and which would make sense, by the way, of all the laws of nature and the order and rationality to the universe, if there is a God, how do we know he hasn't invaded, so to speak, hasn't reached in and done something in the world he created? He's perfectly capable if he created this universe. So it's about your a priori presuppositions, your assumptions about, are you ruling out a miracle from the beginning? Are you saying those just don't happen? Or are you opening yourself to the evidence? I like the quote of Sherlock Holmes in one of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. He says, "It is an old maxim of mine that when you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." And that's, I believe, what we have with the resurrection. Sure, it's improbable. People don't rise from the dead all the time. But you have to look at the surrounding context. You have to look at the prophecies that Jamie talked about. You have to look at the fact that Jesus predicted his death and resurrection multiple times to his disciples over and over. You have to look at the fact that there's an empty tomb still. You still have an empty tomb you got to deal with. To this day, the tomb is empty. We know where Muhammad's tomb is. We know where Buddha's tomb is. People have their, they go and they set up all these shrines for these great religious leaders. We don't do that for Jesus because he's not in his tomb. We have an empty tomb. You got to look at the continuing church. You got to have an explanation for that. Why did this church Jesus movement take off? So again, when you look at all the evidence and you say miracles are at least possible in a world, in a theistic universe where God creates the universe, they're at least possible. I can't rule them out from the beginning. Am I going to require some evidence? Absolutely. And by the way, God is not opposed to that. You know that Thomas, known as Doubting Thomas, he said, "I won't believe until I get some evidence here, people. You 11 men tell me that Jesus rose from the dead." Or sorry, 10 men. Judas was gone. You tell me that you saw Jesus. I didn't. I would like some evidence. Guess what? Jesus gave him evidence. He showed him his scars. He said, "Put your hand here in my side, into my hands, and stop doubting, but believe." And so when we read these gospel testimonies, we got to recognize these are eyewitness. These are based on eyewitness testimonies. These are guys, the very same people who wrote them were willing to go to their deaths. So we can't just discount that and say, oh, they're just like the guy who claims to go to heaven and he has no evidence for it. It's just something he says happened. No, you got to look at what they were willing to endure after writing about their experiences. And this was, again, it's a uniform thing. It's not something else I just got to say that's so incredible is in every other religion, you have the founder being the author of all the sacred texts or the chief sacred texts. Like you got Muhammad writing the Quran. You got Buddha with his writings. Jesus didn't write anything. And that's part of the evidence too. He didn't have to write and say, "Look guys, I came back from the dead. This is how it happened." The evidence was so compelling that his followers picked up the pen and said, "This is what happened to Jesus." He didn't even have to write about it. That's how powerful the evidence was. That's how compelling his resurrection was. They were willing to write about it and die for it. So again, this is a spiritual issue, as you talked about, Jamie, because what happens if we do acknowledge that Jesus rose from the dead, the very obvious thing to begin with is that means he is the Lord of all. He's the Lord of my life. He has every claim to every part of me. If he is the resurrected Lord, I can't go my own way, because he's the Lord. And I think that right there is the single biggest reason why people want to go against the facts, go against the evidence, is because they understand the implications. But I'd be encouraging those of you who are listening, who maybe you're new to this evidence, go out and seek it out for yourself. Don't rest on the laurels of the Bart Ehrmans of this world who say, oh, this evidence is so scant. Look into it yourself. Read what so many other historians have found as they've studied out the evidence. And it is compelling. It's just tremendously compelling. There's no way to deny the facts. As you pointed out, Jamie, there's better evidence for this than that. Even Julius Caesar existed. You got to ask yourself, why is that? Why is there so much evidence for it?
And we would say to a listener maybe out there who's sitting there saying, man, I want in. I want a relationship with Christ. John 11:25, Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though he dies. It's a hope that transcends this world. It's the greatest news. It's the greatest gift. It's the most amazing gospel that Jesus was, that Jesus did, that Jesus died, and he was resurrected so that you and I could be reconciled in relationship with God the Father. You know, John 14, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. And the beauty of what we celebrate in Easter is not just the resurrection of Jesus, but all that the resurrection of Jesus means. And so if you're sitting there saying, you know, I see the evidence, I feel the prompting of the Holy Spirit, take that step into a personal relationship with Christ.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.